Welcome back to the Laravel Podcast Season 3. Today we're going to be talking with Freek van de Herten, something like that. He works with Spasi and they make packages and do all sorts of great things. Stay tuned, you'll learn more. All right, real quick note going into this episode. I just moved offices and I only noticed after moving that the movers bumped the gain knob on my audio. So it's not going to sound great. I apologize ahead of time. But don't blame Michael. It's not his fault. It's my fault. Sort of the movers, but mainly just me. All right, let's get on with the episode. All right, welcome back to the Laravel Podcast Season 3. This is a season where we learn about all sorts of amazing people. You may have heard of them before. You may not have heard of them before, but they're all absolutely incredible. And if their name is not English, then I also mangle it terribly and then they fix it up for me. Today, we're talking to, Freek van de Herten, something like that, who is one of the leads. You're going to do it for me in a second, and then you can grade me on how well I did. And you're also going to have to grade me on how well I do the name of your company, because I have been told that I say it wrong. So Spasi, which apparently is close, but not quite right. So that's a company. They make packages. They do open source Laravel stuff, all this kind of stuff. You've seen their open source packages. You've viewed their packages. You've seen his blog. You've seen him on Twitter, all that kind of stuff. So the first thing that I'm going to ask him to do is first, say his name and his company's name right. Second, grade my pronunciation and see if he can make me do it any better. And third, ask the first question we always ask, which is, when you meet people in the grocery store, how do you tell people what it is that you do?
Okay, let me pronounce it just right. My name is Freek van de Herten. I work for a company called Spasi, and I would grade your pronunciation like 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. So it's pretty good.
Yay, all right. For an American, that's a pretty good number, yeah. So I'll take it.
So at the grocery store, if somebody asks what I do, I simply say that I make websites. I'm a programmer, so I try to make it really easy because I'm mostly on the backend stuff, and for people that are not into backend, that's all a little bit fuzzy. And with websites, they immediately know, he creates those. Yeah. And I always say, I'm not going to install printers. That's not my job. I program stuff. So
that's perfect. Yeah, because if you say I work with computers, that leaves that open, right? Yeah. You might be a networking person or something like that. So, all right. Well, I can hear in your pronunciation a little bit of the ways that I'm off. So I'll go back, listen to this 10,000 times and see if I can get it right. But an 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 for a Southern American, I'm going to take that as a win.
Hey, it's pretty good, man.
All right. Yeah, so I mentioned this real quick, but Spasi, whatever it is, they have 10,000 packages. Some of our questions are going to be about all the Laravel packages you have, a little bit about your tweeting and your sharing of content. But of course, if anybody doesn't know who he is, just check him out. So I also don't know. I know that I asked you personally, and I know that I know where your Twitter handle comes from, but not everybody else does, and I don't actually know how you pronounce it. So tell us your Twitter handle, where it came from, and how you actually say it in your mind.
Well, my Twitter handle is Freek Meurze, and it's actually a very good question where it comes from. Freek is just my first name, but I have actually three names, and that's not that uncommon in Belgium. Most people have multiple first names, and mine are Frederik, because Freek is just is a nickname, actually. My second name is Georgette. And the third name, which is a very special name, I don't think anybody has it now, it's Murzeflus. And Murzeflus is a name given by my parents. And it's an emperor. It's a Byzantine emperor. Because both my parents are lawyers, and when they had me, there was this law in Belgium that you had to pick the name of your child from this big list of names that were approved, and they want to see what the city clerk would do if they just picked the name out of history that is not on that list. So they picked the Murzeflus.
Rebels. I love it.
And the clerk didn't say anything. It just wrote it down. So
did that night. Yeah. Nice. Very cool.
And I've...
it's funny because...
I've also passed it on to my kids. So they also have like Byzantine emperor name. So
I love it. That's awesome. It's funny because I when I first looked it up, I was like, oh, Murzeflus. but it sounds a lot. It sounds a lot more regal when you say
Yeah.
All right. So that's your Twitter handle. So go follow him on Twitter if you don't know. He's got a newsletter and a blog. And one of the things that Freek does a lot is collect together the best stuff from other people. And so the Spotsy creates incredible number of packages. Quite a few of them are original content. But one of the things they also do is they take stuff that other people are doing and they package it up together in a normalized way. So if somebody says, here's a thing on Lyricast or here's an idea or something like that, they will often make a package around it. And Freek both writes his own articles and the people at Spotsy write their own articles. And then they also collect together links to articles from other people around the community. So they're both creators and curators. And that's something that's kind of they're known for. So if you haven't seen them, go check out that stuff that they're doing. Okay, that's fun. Moving on. When did you first get access to a computer? In what context? And what was your interaction with that computer like?
Oh, I started using computers at a very early age. It was actually a console. My dad bought a ColecoVision. I don't know if you know that console. It was very big.
I've never heard of it before.
It was very big in the 80s, I think around 82 or 83. So I must have been three or four when my dad had a console and he let me play on it. And that was the first time I interacted with things on a screen, you know. And
so what kind of operating system was it on?
I don't know. It's a game console, so it's only
gaming console.
Yeah. It only had games on it, and that was the first time I interacted with something and saw something moving on a screen.
Got it.
Now, shortly after that, I think 2 years after, we got our first computer in the house, which was it was definitely a Macintosh, and I think it was an SE model. Okay. It's one of the first models. So my dad was a little bit of a computer freak, and he wanted to buy this new stuff. So I started out with like System 6, I think it was on Mac OS, and I started there was a program on there called maybe some people know it, called HyperCard, which was
I've heard of it.
It's a very simple application which makes it very great. It's just like the stack of cards which you can programmatically do stuff with. It you can say, if somebody clicks here, go to card number 3. If somebody clicks here, go to card number 5. So I started doing, and if you click here, play a sound or display this image. So I made my first, I don't know if I can call it computer programs, but I made my first projects with that, like little games like that, you know?
Yeah.
So that was,
it's funny how different Mac and PC are, because I know about HyperCard. I saw it in school, but I never worked with it. But my first one was BASIC, and it was probably around the same time period. I mean, I guess I was 6 or something. So I was around late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And it was such a different experience. I was learning syntax and code and able to do almost nothing. Whereas with the Mac, it's giving you this like visual interactive system. And it's like such a difference even back then of what you're getting from each of them. So
yeah, because at the school, we had a Windows computer or a Windows 3.1 computer. But the Windows subsystem, that was just a shell. You had also MS-DOS behind it. And when I saw that, I thought, what is this? I'm going back in time with something way better at home, you know? You have this thing like a mouse on there, so.
Yep.
So that,
that's so interesting.
So that was fun. So I've always been busy with computers and creating my own little things on it, so.
Did your interest kind of keep up through school? Did you always think of yourself as a computer person, or?
Yeah, I always knew. Yeah, I want to do something with computers. You know, I studied IT as well. So I'm one of the lucky ones that at a very early age I knew I wanted to do this. You know, but IT is very big. So I did a lot of things on my computer as well. At one point, I also did some sound recording, some songs, because that's another passion of mine. I'm also busy with music. I have my own band.
Okay.
And way,
you gotta tell us more about that in a second.
Yeah. So way before Laravel was there, when I still had time to do other stuff, I created music as well, but that hobby is a little bit on the background right now.
You know what? I actually am going to pause there. What musical instruments do you play? And were you also? It sounds like you were also recording. Were you doing like mixing and mastering, production, and everything?
It's just recording stuff and a little bit of mastering, but I'm not really good at it. You know, my musical taste is a little bit lo-fi. So what I record was lo-fi as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started, my first instrument was, I think, the saxophone when I was 10 years old. I had to do that for my parents. Yeah, you have to do like musical school. But I didn't like it that much, you know. I think the first 2 years were okay, but then I wasn't interested in the saxophone anymore. I tried to pick up the piano and did a year of piano. And then I learned guitar myself, and that's an instrument where I stick a little bit by. So, in all the bands
do you play acoustic or electric more? Sorry, go ahead.
It's more electric these days because I play in a band, and yeah, I have my electric guitar installed there. So I do that more. I do a little finger picking at home. I have an acoustic guitar here, but it's not as much as I used to.
What style of music do you play?
It's a style called krautrock. I don't know if you know that.
I don't. You're gonna have to send me the link later so I can put it in the show notes.
Well, it's like this. It's my favorite kind of music. It's like house music, like dance music, very repetitive, but with guitars instead of electronic instruments. So some good bands that you should check out from the territory was like very big in the 1970s. There are bands like Ken and Noi, and the ideas behind those bands revolve around how do you say that in English? Can we keep things interesting with the least amount of notes, you know, with three notes. Can we do it just by repeating them? We'll make it interesting again. No,
very interesting.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's like an aesthetic that I really liked, like the simple things, you know, the functional things. Not too many whistles and bells with it, but just functional, pure, straight to the point. No.
It's funny because when you said repetitive, the first thing I thought of was jam bands. And a lot of jam bands are a lot of noise. You got 20 people on stage, but they're very repetitive. And they're not interesting to me because you get the same, everybody's playing the same noisy notes over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So it seems almost the opposite, at least in my very judgmental perspective, where you're trying to have very little noise, but actually keep it interesting. So
yeah, I'll send you some interesting pieces to you. I'll put
it on the show notes, everybody.
I've recently listened again to a few versions of a piece called In C. I don't know if you know it. It's like a musical piece. I can't remember the author right now. It's probably, it will go in my mind in a few seconds. And it's like 18 melodies of music. And it's like 20 people playing them. And there are a few rules around it. It's when somebody plays like the fourth tune, everybody still on the first tune should skip to the second. You know, there can only be a gap of two. And then you go slowly to the end and it lasts about like an hour. And it are very simple melodies, but they interlock very, very well together. And it's not written on paper how much times you have to repeat each melodic phrase. So every version is a little bit different. And that's interesting music to me.
So you could theoretically have one musician who's just really antsy to move on and the whole thing would be done in 20 minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, that could be the case. Yeah. There are
everyone's glaring at that one guy.
There are like hundreds of versions of that, but they're all amazing.
Very interesting. Huh. Okay. Like I said, I'm going to get him to write all this down for us. Links in the show notes later.
Yeah, sure.
I'm super interested to learn about that. So you said you don't do as much music now. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true.
Did I hear you right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So when I was a little bit younger, I think when I was like around 20s, then I had a little studio in my own apartment. And yeah, I recorded lots of songs. That was my main hobby then. Nowadays it's programming, but then it was like, yeah, every moment of free time that I have to record stuff. I have to experiment with stuff, which is, yeah. So I listen back to those recordings like every 5 years or something. And I'm still a little bit proud. Hey, that is something that I accomplished, you know? That's cool.
Yeah, I spend that much time. I got that good. Even if I couldn't do that right now, that's still something I did.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to ask you more questions about that, but I also want to get to the end as well. So, all right. So you were, when you first got into that, you said you had access to those Windows computers in school. So what did your school education look like? At what point did you start getting more than just kind of typing lessons?
I think when I was like 14 or 15, we had lessons in a thing called IsoLab. I don't know if that is a well-known program or not, but it's something we teach at school, and it's basically like this grid, and there is a car in it, and there are certain obstacles, and you have to write an algorithm to let the car reach a special end spot. And then
I want to do that now.
Yeah. And it's like something to exercise things like loops, like memory, like and or not kind of stuff. And that are the first things that I learned to do. We also had a little bit of Visual Basic before I went into higher education. So we programmed things like things in Access, that's like this Microsoft database, where we had to program the screens and special reports and stuff like that. And I only got into programming, into real programming, like with computer languages in higher education, where I got to learn C++ and COBOL, things like that. Yeah, I learned.
Now, were you doing IT? was it IT then, or were you specializing more in computer science?
It was. I don't know how you say it in how you translate the thing that I studied in English, but it's focused on practical IT. It's
okay.
But it was like in 1989 that I studied higher education, and yeah, internet wasn't this big like it is now. And we didn't have any lessons on HTML or the web. It was all on this like enterprisey kind of stuff that we had to learn, like Java, like C++, things like that. Yeah.
Huh. So when you say secondary education, do you mean when you were 18 years old or when you were 14 years old?
Secondary education, that's from 12 years old till 18 years old. And when you're,
got it. Okay.
And when you're 18 years old, you go to higher education. Some people go to most people.
So even in 12 to 18 years old, you were able to specialize, because in the U.S. in 12 to 18, you just do whatever they tell you to do. There's no specialization or anything like that.
Yeah, there are.
So you were able to kind of focus on a certain track.
Yeah. You can from 12 years old, or I think from 13, you can really pick your direction if you want to. Do like a language kind of education, like a mathematical based education, like an IT kind of education. So you can make a choice there a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when did you? Oh, go ahead.
And of course, when you're 18, then you have much more choices. So then you can choose basically anything that you want.
Okay. So where did you go after secondary education then?
So I did my secondary education in my hometown, which is a small town in the northern part of Belgium. But I always knew that, when I'm going for the higher education, I don't want to live at home anymore. I want to live with myself, all my friends were in that mindset. no, when we're 18, we're going to move, and we're going to get away from our parents, even though we all love our parents. It's not none of it.
Yep, but
we're now grown-ups. That's the thing.
Exactly.
So I moved to the biggest city in the vicinity of my hometown, which is a city called Antwerp.
Okay.
Where I've lived for a long time, and Spassi is still based there. And I went to school there, and I lived all my student life in the city of Antwerp. So
okay, that's actually one of the only cities I know there. So that's a good win for me. I'm nodding. I've actually heard of that before. That's good. Go me.
You should come to Antwerp. It's a beautiful city. I would love to.
Yeah.
It's not that far from Amsterdam.
I said in the last podcast, once you get Americans over to Europe, we don't want to leave because it's so expensive to get over there.
Yeah.
Which is why I was so crazy. I was there for Laravel Life UK for 5 days and then came home. But the next, I'm trying to get my kids to the age where I can take them over, because once I have the whole family over there, I'll just work from there. It doesn't matter. So I'm hoping someday in the next couple of years, we'll get a whole month and just go see everybody in the whole Laravel world and just kind of stay in everybody's town for a couple of days. So Antwerp's on the list.
Well, you're certainly welcome here. So do that.
All right. I won't get booed out of town. That's good. Okay, so you went out. So what did you study? Was it continued practical IT, or was it something different when you went into higher education?
Yeah, that was practical IT that I studied. So that were the more enterprise stuff things that I learned there. Yeah, the things like C++, like some math was still there, like things like analysis, how do you cope with a big project. And looking back at it, I really like what I was teach there, but a lot of the things that I learned there after the years, I thought what they taught me was a little bit wrong.
I was gonna ask how you reflected on your education. Is there more you can say about that? Or is there broad strokes you can make about what was good and what was bad?
Yeah, so something that has really struck with me is in one of the first lessons I was taught, and I did that like for years, is like, it's a very practical thing. A function can only have one return statement. And that fucked my career up so bad. You know?
Yeah, I believe it.
Enlightenment came only 10 years after, going, hey, we can... Uh-huh. It's actually better to have early returns, but things like object statistics, I don't know when those ideas came, but they certainly weren't taught at school. So, I'm skipping ahead 10 years now, but there was a time that I thought, man, I really wish that there were a few teachers back then that knew about the stuff that I'm learning now, because there is much more than the stuff that they taught me. It's not all bad, you know. It's not all bad. They taught some good stuff as well, you know. With the things I learned there, I landed my first job, which was something I didn't expect. I was like a COBOL programmer for 7 years or something like that.
Okay.
And
yeah.
I still remember when I was at the job interview, and they asked me, so what do you want to do? And I said, like anything except COBOL. And and then they gave me COBOL, and I did it for like 7 years, but it was kind of fun to do it. It was I worked for a major bank. Maybe you know it. It's called ING. I think you have.
I used to have, or maybe still do. I don't know.
I think they're operating in America as well. And I programmed COBOL there for the mainframe. So
we did
like the financial stuff. So it was kind of important what we did there. And I still look back very fondly to that period, because I had very good colleagues there. And we could do amazing stuff, even with like an old language like COBOL. We could really do some. We really could program some nice solutions. And sometimes I miss the scale a little bit of programming in that way, because that's like for like 1/5 of the country has an account on ING.
Yeah,
and that's kind of fun to work on. on such high scale things.
I know we're getting ahead of ourselves just a bit, but I asked this of JT as well. Programming COBOL and the programmers who've been in COBOL for years and the patterns and practices you have are a little different, I imagine, than working with Laravel.
Yeah.
Is there something, one or two things that you experienced or learned during your time there that you think that a lot of us who haven't had that sort of experience could benefit from hearing about? Any practices or any maxims or any sayings or, you know, testing patterns or anything that, you know, you experienced there that you wish more people knew about?
Let me think. One of the things that, they already did at the time is testing a lot, but it was in a in an old way, so I can't recommend that.
Okay.
I think what the, what sticks with me most from that time is not a technical programming thing that we did, but the team we did it with. With like the communication between the team, and we were in within the firm, we were one of the first group that wrote like standards for ourselves. We are going to name variables like this. We are indenting our code a little bit like that. We're going to use prefixes for that. We're going to use suffixes for that, which was really beneficial. And that's something, yeah, we do at our company, at Spasi now as well. And yeah, that's something I think a lot of people could learn a little bit from, just to have some guidelines and be very, how do you say that in English? I can't remember the word. Just do everything always the same.
Consistent, yeah.
Consistent, keep consistent. You know, things like using like a dash or an underscore when you case things, they seem like, hey, this is not important, but it's actually very important when you work in a team.
Yeah, and, totally agree.
Yeah, and that's something I picked up with working in a good team at the ING.
Very cool. All right, so you got a job at ING right out of higher education, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what made you move and where'd you move to?
Well, that's a good question. So when I was working at ING for a couple of years, there were plans to split up the branch I was working in. So I worked in like the insurance branch, and ING sold it off to another company. So it became apparent that that our team had to split and to move to different cities. And at the time, I didn't want to move cities, you know. So I went for another job in Antwerp, another company that also does COBOL. But I was a little bit shell-shocked there because at ING, because I worked there for so long, I had like this network of people, and I could get things done, you know. I didn't have to follow the rules. I could cut some red tape. But at that new company, I didn't have a network, and it was so, so very frustrating for me that I couldn't get any things done. Now, at the time, I also had a band with a friend of mine called Willem. And Willem, he just started this little company called Spasi.
I was going to say, I've heard that name before.
And he was doing everything by itself. Everything by himself. He programmed a little. He designed a little. He did all the client work by himself. And I'm sure it came up at the band rehearsal. Yeah, well, I really hate my job now. And then he said, yeah, don't you want to program for the web? Because I felt that He couldn't do everything by his own anymore. You know, he was good in design, but he didn't like programming as much. So he looked for somebody that wanted to program a little bit. But I wasn't certain at the time. So I did a couple of stuff for Will first. But there's no way to sugarcoat this. Because I was so bored at my job, I started just creating websites at my job itself, because I had basically, this is the honest truth, they didn't give me enough work, so they gave me an assignment. Yeah, this is your assignment for a week. And like after 2 hours, it was done. So I report that to management. Give me more work.
Yep.
And they didn't give me more work. So I started programming for the web and learning stuff for the web. And after a half a year or something, I said, yeah, this is silly. I'm just working for myself at this job. So yeah, I'm just going to quit, you know? And then, I started working for Spasi.
What's your official role there right now?
I'm, I guess, the lead developer there.
Okay.
Although I don't like the term a little bit, that's what we tell people that we meet. You know, Freek is our lead developer. So I still do a lot of programming day to day myself. Mm-hmm. But I also help my colleagues getting things done, you know? Yeah. I don't like the thing about the leads with the term lead programmer. The thing that I don't like is like, this is the one that makes all the decisions and does all the cool stuff, but I don't see that as my role. I have to help the other people getting their job done. So that's an important factor of the things I'm doing day to day. And there's also a little bit leading the company a little bit because I'm a partner there. So there's a lot of corporate stuff I need to do there as well. So But the best days.
How many people aren't?
The best days are the days that I can program myself. So
yeah, I totally feel you. How many people are in your team?
We're now with 7 people.
Okay. So the two of you, is it 5 programmers or are there any non-programmers on the team?
There are now two non-programmers. Oh, actually, we're with 8. We had a new hire like 2 weeks ago. We're with 8 now.
Congrats.
Thanks. We're with 5 programmers, 1 designer, and the rest is project manager. So they handle like client stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. But our heart is in like programming bigger Laravel applications now. So we started with like smaller CMS kind of sites, mm-hmm. but we moved on a little bit to the bigger things. That's also a story in itself, really.
I don't know if we're gonna have time for, but I'm actually very curious about that story. But I have to pause this one time. Is there a t sound at the end of the name of your company or not? Is it purely just Spasi?
Yeah.
Sometimes I hear a little T and sometimes I don't. So
no, it's Spasi. It's like your pronunciation for Spasi is like 10 out of 10. It's perfect. It's good. Just
okay.
Spasi.
Yeah. Spasi. Okay. I was saying Spazi for a while with a T. So that so Spasi.
Spasi. Yeah.
Okay.
It's perfect.
Got it.
Perfect.
All right. Now that's 10 out of 10. I got an 8 out of 10 my first time. You didn't even notice. So, okay. All right. So I do want to talk about your relationship with the company, what kind of stuff you all are doing, because I think that there's a lot of companies that do Laravel and there's not a lot of companies that have public presence that are creating a lot of content and stuff like that. And so I think what I want to know is, let's not even talk about the company yet. Let's talk about you.
Mm-hmm.
When did you go from being a programmer to a programmer who had garnered a reputation as someone who created packages and taught stuff? How intentional was it? What did that transition look like? I mean, what was Freek being a programmer who did web stuff to mm-hmm. being Freek being like a well-known teacher? What the shift between those look like?
Well, it certainly wasn't intentional. I think like now 6 or 7 years ago, we were still, this is the time before we did Laravel. We were creating sites with like Zend Framework 1, mm-hmm. CMS kind of sites. And I remember getting a little bit bored with it because at the time, mm-hmm. the PHP world was becoming a little bit stale. I thought this was also pre-Composer. There was another ecosystem that attracted my attention. And it's really no surprise. That's Ruby on Rails. That's a story I share with a lot of people in our community, I think. So I created a few Rails sites, and I thought, we're ready to jump ship of PHP. You know, PHP is done. Mm-hmm. But then Composer happened and Laravel happened. So we started doing Laravel sites. And in Zend Framework, we had this whole CMS, a homegrown CMS build up. And I wanted to have that in Laravel. Now, I wanted to do it a piece at a time. And at the time, there was this guy called Jeffrey Way. He started Laracast.
And yeah, this little site.
Yeah, this little site. Very small. And he put out a video how to use Travis and GitHub together. And my mind was a little bit blown that you could just run your test and see the interface of GitHub if your tests were passing or not. And the lesson of Jeffrey was also around package development. And I thought, yeah, no, I want to do that as well. So I'm going to try to write a package. And I think one of the first ones was, I think, the Geocoder one, which is a wraparound Geocoder service of Hool. And or it was BrowserShot maybe, which was a package that used Phantom JS to create a screenshot of a web page. And yeah, I put that out, and yeah, some people liked it, which was like mind blowing to me. There's somebody here that did a pull request to fix a typo. Wow, this is really awesome, you know.
Right.
So I thought, yeah, I have to write another package. And when I took a look again at the Zend Framework 1 CMS, I saw, yeah, there's MailChimp in here, there's Google Analytics in here, there's something called the Media Library to handle assets. And I thought, yeah, these are all packages. Maybe I should just program, I should all package them up for Laravel. So
yeah,
I it wasn't planned, but I spent the next 2 or 3 years just doing that, putting that just out,
repackaging, yeah,
just repackaging the old Zend Framework A code, Zend Framework 1 code, to like modern packages with all the stuff I learned on Laracast. Now at the same mm-hmm. time, I was still the only programmer at Spasi, so we were only a three man company. And we had like an internal platform. It was something Microsofty. I can't remember the name, where we put like interesting links on. And I was discovering so much interesting good content on the internet, and I posted it there. But my two colleagues, like the project manager and the designer, we're not interested in like that deep programming stuff that you're putting there. No, we're interested in the ideas, but not in like the nitty-gritty details. So then I thought, hey, I'll just start a blog and I'll just put those links just publicly on there. You know, this is the stuff mm-hmm. that interests me. Maybe other programmers are interested as well. So, and with that combination, with like starting a blog and writing about those packages, I guess, yeah, it picked up a little bit from there. People just liked the content that was there. Both my own stuff as the links that I shared, and yeah, it only mm-hmm. grew from there. So but it certainly wasn't planned, like we're going to be well known with this. That was the plan from the get-go.
Yeah. I noticed this initial commit on BrowserShot is May 2nd, 2014.
Yeah,
four short years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I did a lot in the past few years.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that it really helps to have some kind of structure to work along. So the structure you're saying is, hey, you know what? I'm going to take this list of packages and I'm just going to work through them. And those sorts of structures that just give you something to work on next means you're never stuck asking the question of, oh no, what do I do next? You've always got something. You just got to make the time and put the effort in. So
yeah, sure. And nowadays, and yeah, actually the couple of past years, the most packages get born in client projects. So if there's a client project that's like API heavy, then we create some packages to make API development a little bit more easy in Laravel. And I also want to mention, because I'm talking about me here a lot, but it Now it sounds like that I'm the only one creating packages, but my colleagues do a tremendous amount of work on that as well. It's I want to emphasize that the open source efforts are our team effort. So it's not me alone. Although I'm the most known one, my colleagues, Brent, Alex, Sepp, Willem, do also incredible stuff out there.
Yeah. And actually, that's one of the things I was going to ask, because, you know, we're always figuring things out on Titan. I mean, we give everybody 20% time. So quite a bit of the work that's done at Titan is done on those Fridays, but not all of it. Sometimes people are doing stuff in their own personal time. And you and I have talked a little bit about in the past about kind of what that looks like for you all, especially because you put out just such a prolific number of packages as a company. Yeah. Are you able to make that much time available, or are people doing work at night? And so you and I have talked about it, but again, let's imagine we have not.
Okay.
What does it look like for you, and what does it look like for the other people in the team? I mean, how much of this stuff are you doing during the day job, and how many hours are you and the other folks working in the evenings or even nights and weekends, I guess?
Well, for the company, we always plan the stuff that we need to do on the Monday. We sit together and we say, hey, you're doing this week, you're doing that this week, and we only plan 4 days. So for the fifth day, you can do whatever you want, but that fifth day, that isn't a separate day. You know, it's like the time in between. It's when you're bored with this project, yeah, go do something open source, write a blog post or write a package or whatever. So we have like 1 day a week for everybody that can work on this open source stuff. Now, that's the theory. But yeah, in practice, yeah, packages get made in project time a little as well, because yeah, they're made for that project.
Right.
So it's a little bit hazy where to draw the line a little bit.
Sure.
And sure. I know that I spent a lot of time also open sourcing a little bit after the hours because I like it. And sometimes colleagues, when they have like this good idea or a good vibe, I notice that they too do stuff in the evening, even though that's really not required to do so. It's really because they personally like like doing this. And yeah. I think we've made so many packages now. It's really not such a big effort for us now to work on a package, because We know what are the good things, the basic guidelines are for a good package. We know that we have to have tests. We know that we have need to have good documentation. We know how things like a service provider works. We can we have empathy enough now to imagine how people are going to use our stuff. So because we've done it a lot, it gets a little bit easier for us as well to do too. So people sometimes ask, isn't that difficult to do, to invest so much knowledge and time in that? But I think for a company, it's kind of easy because, it has grown a little bit in our DNA, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if in a project, a colleague of mine comes to me, hey, Frick, should I package this up? Yeah, default answer is, yeah, if you can't do it, just take a couple of hours, or if it's a bigger package, an hours of day, a couple of days extra, and just do it, because we will benefit from it anyways, you know. Maybe not because we are going to attract clients with it, but the programmer making the package will become a better programmer. For Spacy, it's good because we have something in our package tool belt a little bit more. I always, when somebody takes an effort of making the package, I make sure that I mention the principal author of that package, which is not always me also on things. So everybody benefits with this, you know? And I wish more companies would do this, you know? Because if you take some time to do this, it isn't hard anymore. It just becomes part of your workflow to do this.
It's interesting because at Titan, we have a little bit of an inverse culture. People say, oh, we should make a package out of that. I'm like, are you sure that you want to maintain that for the next 4 years? Because if you don't, then don't make a package out of it. And I've actually talked people out of making packages because I know that they don't yet understand what the cost of being an open source author looks like. And it's not that I'm ever going to tell anybody no, but I am going to tell them and make sure that you know that the burden that comes on the moment people have this package in their, you know, in their 3 years out of date app, and what kind of, you know, customer support, you know, you're asking. And so I'm actually talking people out of it frequently. And what I'm more likely doing is somebody says something interesting, I'm like, have you written a blog post about it? And they're also, quite a few people who are like, yeah, Matt, I just put it on the list of 40 blog posts you should tell me I'm supposed to write. You're going to have to start giving me more than one day a week to do these things. But no, I love your attitude towards packages. And one of the things we've talked about in the past is that, you know, we need all kinds of types. And, you know, like, for example, the packages we have at Titan, there's only, you know, a few of them, and we maintain them back to Laravel 5.1.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things you've mentioned is you say, look, we keep up to the most modern versions. And if somebody else wants to fork it and make an older version, then they're welcome to do so.
Yeah.
And so like each group, each company, each author has like different things to contribute and to offer. And so I love the more people that are willing to make those packages, the more of a broad spectrum we have of people who are willing to participate in some way, shape, or form. There might be some company or person who comes along and their goal in life is to maintain all of Spotsy's packages back to Laravel 5.1 or something like that. Who knows? So each of us is kind of contributing a different thing to the community. So
yeah, sure. Yeah, the cost of being a maintainer is a high cost sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good that you make people aware of that. For us, we carry the load as a team. So everybody does a little bit of maintenance, and we have the pleasure of having a lot of people in the community helping us out as well. We have, for every package, there are a lot of contributors there. So yeah, I'm pretty happy where we stand right now. And I've also learned to sometimes just let it go, you know? Like two or three years ago, I wanted to have like the issue count as low as possible, the PR count as low as possible. And now I've learned, you know, that really isn't important. You know, if there are some more fun stuff to do, just leave it open. I'm not obliged in any way to do this kind of work unless I'm very happy to do it myself, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And that idea of you should be very happy with this kind of work, that's also where that idea comes from, that we only do like the latest Laravel version, we do the latest PHP version, because this is what we use on our own project, and this is these are the versions we like working with. Nobody on our team likes working with like the older Laravel versions. I'm not saying working with all the Laravel versions is bad or something, but we take the most joy out of working with the latest stuff. So it makes sense for us only to do support for the latest stuff in our package as well. Unless it's very easy to support all the things, then we do that as well. But and we're also not afraid to just abandon an old package if we just don't like it anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like anybody's going to sue us.
Yeah, it comes down to the question of what do you feel obligated to do? And I think there's often a perception, right or wrong, that once you put that code up out there, you're obligated to maintain it. And interestingly, I see both sides of the issue, because on the one hand, I don't think that you can be forced to do anything. And on the other hand, I can imagine somebody saying, well, I can't, like, we have a lot of clients who can't upgrade to the latest Laravel or the latest PHP because they're stuck on whatever Red Hat releases. And, you know, there's several versions behind and they're saying, man, I'd really like to use that new Spotsy package, but I can't. Spotsy package, but I can't. but at the same time, well, what's the inverse? Oh, you have to do something? No, nobody can force you to do anything. And so I have bounced back and forth a lot of times. And I think where I've ended up is just saying, no, nobody can be forced to do anything. Each person needs to be honest about what they're planning to do, and also the world needs to allow them to change what their plans are if they change what their plans are. And as long as you're not manipulating or tricking people, then you're an open source contributor who's putting work out there in the world and people can consume it. And if they're not happy with it, they can take the responsibility to fix it up. And if they're not willing to take that responsibility to fix it up, then it's kind of like, well, that's, you know, you're getting free stuff and, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth is an American saying there. So,
yeah.
So I'm very sad because I have to go home to take care of my kids, but I can't leave just on that note because, as always, I ask people in Titan what questions they have for you. I can't ask all of them because of my timeline, but I am going to at least ask you a few of them. So especially the ones that are the most esoteric. Number one, how many postcards do you get per month?
We should get more. I think it's about like between 15 or 25, something like
and
this, that.
And it's your packages are postcardware, which means basically what you ask people to do is if they use the package, consider sending you a postcard from wherever they're from. Yeah. So I assume that most people don't feel the pressure to send you like 5,000 postcards if they use your package, but you probably should at least get one postcard from each user. So listeners, if you've ever used the Spossy package somewhere, consider going and buying a postcard from your locale and going, sending it. They've got a thing on their website about it, a link in the show notes. But it sounds like that number should be a little bit higher. So let's all go chip in there to thank them.
Thanks, man.
The next random question, I don't even know how to pronounce this, so I'm just going to read the words in front of my face. Did Romelu Lukaku deserve the golden boot?
Yeah, I think he does. Or Eden Hazard.
Okay.
That are two football players, if you don't know that.
I have no idea at all. There's a lot of people taking care about this, but I don't, so...
I'm not that big into football, but I did watch for the World Cup. That's when I'm interested in the Belgian team. And when looking at the Belgian matches this time, I was really amazed what our player Eden Hazard could do. Did some amazing stuff. So that's your answer.
All right. Several people asked this, but I feel like you're not going to have this list ready. So if you don't have this list ready, just say I don't have this list ready. But several people asked, what packages have you made that have been adopted into the Laravel core?
I think none.
Oh, really?
I think that's
in that list.
Wait. There are none in the dependencies, but there are a few that were totally,
programmed absorbed
into Laravel itself, like the I think Migrate Fresh is one of ours. Mm-hmm. That Taylor picked up on because we made it. And I think there's another one where if you in Tinker use a class name, that it can fetch the fully qualified class name. We packaged that up. That was actually
from
Caleb. Yeah,
very cool. I didn't realize that got pulled in the core.
Yeah, and that's in the core now. If you do open up a Tinker session and you do like one of the classes there, then it will try to get a fully qualified class name.
It's a joint Titan Spossy effort.
Yeah, cool.
Jose asks, which artisan commands do you use the most?
I think Tinker all day. Mm-hmm. All day I use Tinker.
Interesting.
I have this package called Laravel Tail, which can tail a log file.
That's the one that was pulled out from old Laravel, right?
Yeah, it was pulled out of Laravel. Yeah, yeah. I don't know why, because it was such a handy thing. And I use that all day long. So
I love it. I love it.
Tailing stuff. And various make commands as well. So So nothing too special there.
Yeah. All right. One last one. Marge asks, what was your most interesting challenge as a new developer?
I think getting to know the best practices and communities, because it's so easy to just program a little thing, like a little PHP script, but how to do it well and how to structure it really well, that was really hard as a newcomer to find good sources of information. And for PHP, I know my way around. I know where I can find good stuff, and I know where the good people are. But if I want to get that feeling again, I know I can try to do some Elixir stuff or maybe even some JavaScript stuff. And it's like, I'm a newcomer all over again. Yeah. You know,
it's the difference between the difference between knowing how to do the thing and the best way to do the thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I totally
agree. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's comforting that in PHP I have the feeling that I can be happy with the stuff that I write. I'm always learning, of course, but it's difficult to have that in another language because you're so familiar and it feels so warm doing PHP. But I have to force myself a little bit to do some other stuff well. You know,
I hear that. As always, I can tell I could talk for hours on several of our subjects, but is there anything you wanted to cover that we haven't gotten to today?
If I can make a shameless plug.
Please, go ahead.
I launched my first software as a service project like half a year ago. It's called Odir. It's like the best uptime tool out there. It can also detect mixed content when your certificates will expire, things like broken links. You will get notifications from that. It's something I'm really proud of, and you should definitely check it out. It's at odir.app.
Yep, and we will link all this in the show notes. I will make sure that's all available there. The pricing for Odir, I'm trying to remember whether you did it based on the number. It's based on number of sites, right?
It's based on number of sites and nothing else.
Yeah. Yep. So your site could be massive. It could have tens of thousands of pages and you're not going to pay extra for it. So
no.
Yeah, definitely check it out. Odir.ohdear.app. We'll put this all in the show notes. And yeah, we're always down for the shameless plugs. You took your time to talk to us, so we got to give you some love.
All right, thanks.
All right, so if somebody wants to follow you, where's the best way for them to go to do that?
I think it's Twitter is a good way. So my handle is Freek Meurze. It will be in the show notes as well, I presume.
Yep.
Or my blog, meurze.be, where I talk about the package developments that my team and I are doing, and where I link articles of amazing articles of other authors as well. So my blog and my Twitter account, that are the best ways.
Love it. Freek, thank you so much for everything you do for our community. Thank you for your time. I'm sorry I'm cutting us short. Could we keep going? But look forward to seeing you soon. And thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Matt. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.